From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, Boots on the Ground, Stories from the War in Iraq, a special series from To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, covering the war. Journalists have played a pivotal role in the Iraq War, from their frontline reports of battles to their stories of the abuses at Abu Ghraib. But critics say our journalists failed, that they weren't rigorous enough in questioning our government's justifications for starting the war. And the new system of embedded journalism raises a fundamental question about media coverage. Can journalists get the real story when their lives depend on the soldiers who protect them?
For 4 days now, they have been taking incoming fire from this group of buildings you can see through the mist.
We are embedded with the 2-5 Marines. That's the 2nd Battalion, 5th Regiment of the 1st Marine Division out of Camp Pendleton.
And I'm going to describe what I'm seeing here, though. Just you're certainly hearing this in the background. It's Marines using their 240 mounted machine gun on their Humvee, firing into an alleyway to clear it so other Marines and other Humvees can pass through that alleyway.
Hey, let's go. Go.
Snipers have just apparently started firing in this area. U.S. troops are spreading out to determine where the shooting is coming from.
We've heard at least 20 loud explosions like that over the last 10 minutes or so. Here's another one.
But first, what do embedded journalists think of the embed system? What do they think of the war itself? These aren't the kind of questions journalists are often asked. How they feel or think isn't really part of the who, what, when, where, and why of journalism. But Wall Street Journal embedded reporter Fanaz Fasihi mulled over these questions in a personal email to friends and family. The email, somehow, got beyond Fasihi's circle and kept getting forwarded around the world. Her email proved to be very controversial. Some reporters criticized Fasihi for not being an objective journalist, but not Mike Hoyt, the executive editor of the Columbia Journalism Review. In fact, he encouraged his staff to ask other embeds similar questions. Their answers are compiled in the book Reporting Iraq, an oral history of the war by the journalists who covered it. Mike Hoyt read some of Fanaz Fasihi's email to Steve Paulson.
She said being a foreign correspondent in Baghdad these days is like being under virtual house arrest. I leave when I have a very good reason to and at a scheduled interview. I avoid going to people's homes and never walk in the streets. I can't go grocery shopping anymore, can't eat in restaurants, can't strike a conversation with strangers, can't look for stories, can't drive in anything but a full armored car, can't go to scenes of breaking news stories, can't be stuck in traffic, can't speak English outside, can't take a road trip, can't say I'm an American, can't linger at checkpoints, can't be curious about what people are saying, doing, feeling, and can't.
So you couldn't do what she'd always done as a reporter anymore.
She was very frustrated. You know, she was worried about the way things were going. She said the genie of terrorism, chaos, and mayhem has been unleashed into this country as a result of American mistakes. Some editor types thought she had sort of broken a journalistic rule of putting some opinion and emotion in. We thought it was great. It kind of broke through a barrier and helped you understand what it was like in Iraq, which was, you know, her job.
Did that email resonate with a lot of other reporters who were covering Iraq?
Some were critical of it. They said it diminished what they were able to do. But most of them, I think, thought it was right on the money.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to quote something from your book. It's Deborah Amos of NPR who said, "In the early days, we were up against an incredibly powerful spin machine that accused us of only telling the bad news. And so it was very hard to get that information out." So it sounds like there was a lot of pressure to report good news. Was this pressure coming from the government itself or also coming from newspaper editors?
I think for the most part it was coming from the Coalition Provisional Authority during the period when they ran Iraq and Mr. Bremer and company, which employed a lot of political hacks and frankly a lot of propagandists and who wanted to hear what they wanted to hear. And they'd have these press conferences and reporters would one after another say, you know, I'm not seeing what you're describing. And there was tremendous tension there, you know, sort of an unspoken message that you're not with the program. You know, you're just, an America hater or you don't like the military, whatever. And yet the story, you know, that reporters to a man and a woman more or less said that, you know, they were not there to tell the good news or the bad news. They were there to tell the story. And the story at that period was, you know, pretty awful, moving from uncontrolled chaos to insurrection and then edging toward civil war.
And suddenly it wasn't safe for especially American reporters to go out without a military escort. I mean, they could easily get killed.
Some of them certainly did get killed, and others came close. Dexter Filkins of the New York Times tells a kind of harrowing story in our book of coming across the car bomb scene and the whole crowd turning on him and his driver, you know, blaming him for it. You know, he didn't see the logic, but he wanted to get out of there, and he barely got out. I mean, they counted some 30 rocks thrown at the car when they got out of there. He had a very large driver who grabbed him and pulled him in, and he says the crowd almost physically held the car back, but they managed to get away. And there are just a lot of stories like that.
So one of the responses then was you didn't really want to go out there just with a driver trying to get these stories yourself. It was a lot easier, a lot safer to go with an American military unit.
At some point, you couldn't go by yourself. And also, you know, even before this point, you certainly saw certain aspects of the war by going with the military. I mean, I think the good reporters worked hard at trying to do other kinds of information gathering. You know, you do get the military perspective when you're with the military, and the civilians are not likely to talk to you, or they're not likely to talk to you the way they would if a lot of people with big guns were not nearby.
You have a number of comments from reporters who weigh in on the whole embed system. Could you read a few of those?
Yeah. Patrick Colbert, The Independent, very tough, brave reporter who actually spent some time with people who were slowly developing into insurgents early in the war. He said, I think it's a great mistake to go with American units and report on any Iraqi city because I think it's in the nature of things that you're not actually meeting local people, and if you are, you aren't meeting them in circumstances in which they can actually speak. But I think he's in the minority. I mean, I think most reporters think that you're going to learn a lot more by embedding than not embedding. To me, one of the quotes that sums this up is Tom Lasseter from Knight Ridder, or former Knight Ridder. He says, to me, not embedding is like not going to a mosque. I can't imagine going to Iraq without spending the time I've spent in mosques there, and I can't imagine having gone to Iraq without spending the time that I've spent embedding. I mean, it's just part of the story. It's how you see the parts of the country.
Mm-hmm. Well, this whole question, I mean, this has been an incredibly difficult war to cover well, just because of all the restrictions on reporters. And these are incredibly dedicated journalists. But it does raise the question of how good a picture of the Iraq war we're getting around the world. What's your sense of that?
I think it depends on when you're asking. I think for a while there, we were getting a pretty good picture. But if you're talking about now, I think it's a failure, actually. I think something's going on now that's kind of dangerous. I mean, there's not much coverage of the war now, and it's sort of dramatic. And I think it reflects just a lack of interest. I mean, I think America's tired of hearing about the war.
Do all the problems in terms of covering this war raise some fundamental issues of how conventional journalism can do it? I mean, the problems of getting multiple sources, for instance, fact-checking. I mean, it's just extremely difficult to do there. I'm wondering if the so-called objective standards of journalism just don't work very well.
I wouldn't go that far. I mean, I think reporters have done tremendous work over there, done very well. I do think, and doing this book kind of made me come to this thinking, that there needs to be a lot of thought given to the conventions of journalism, the form, the kind of fairly dry, objective way we tell stories. I mean, back to Farnaz Fasihi, when she did that email and it gone public, she got emails from readers afterwards who said, you know, why didn't you tell us it was that bad in Iraq? And she was shocked. She said, you tell me that you're a regular reader of the Wall Street Journal, you've read my stuff, I did tell you. But the fact is she told them in conventional objective prose and this sort of first-person, hard-hitting, somewhat emotional thing that she wrote just broke through that barrier. And I'm not in favor of all reporters just going out and sharing their feelings and so forth, but people like this who have been there 2, 3, 4 years and really know the situation, they have an authority that I think we should loosen the reins and let them write in first-person or whatever it takes. I think that kind of writing, that kind of form would get at a more essential truth, I think.
Can you give me an example of that? Something you could pull from your book? Maybe we could end on this note of a reporter who's just telling it like it is.
You know, there's one that comes to mind. It might take me a minute to find it. Mm-hmm. Skaith Abdul Ahad from The Guardian and Getty Images. He was a photographer and a writer and a very articulate guy. I've had people tell me, when you go to car bomb scenes, try to take these pictures that suggest the scene without really showing the goriness of the scene. But I'm sorry, what do I do? Just turn around and take a picture of the crying woman instead of taking a picture of the dying bodies? Again, I feel very strongly about this thing. People should see. People should realize. It's really ugly out there. And you should see it. You can't censor reality. You can't censor the war. You can't always be sensitive to the feelings of your readers because it's reality. We're trying to cover the realities, and sometimes I strongly believe that because of the security situation in Iraq, because some of us are really jaded, we're not actually conveying how horrible the situation is on the ground. I mean, I can agree with the debate that we're not getting the full picture because the full picture is so bad in Iraq. And still reading newspapers, you get A, B, and C is bad and D and E is good, so this is kind of balanced reporting. It almost reaches the point where there's nothing good. I mean, what? Kids are going to the school, but kids used to go to the school before the war. Electricity? Getting 2 hours of electricity instead of one? It's absurd. This whole debate about good news versus bad news is absurd. What's happening in Iraq is really bad. And he goes on, so this debate accusing the media of not conveying the good news is such a, I mean, do those people know what we were digging through when we go to Iraq? Just flying into Baghdad, driving, just doing the simplest, the basic, simple things, just being in Baghdad, existing in Baghdad, is one of the most dangerous things you can do in your life, let alone covering it. So the effort we put into writing a story, any simple story, is enormous. And none of us, I don't know any journalist who accepts taking such a risk just to manipulate the truth or write the bad news because you have this hidden agenda. People are getting killed on a sectarian basis. People are leaving their neighborhoods. The lines are there. Militias are roaming the streets. Despots are functioning in Iraq. People are getting kidnapped. People are getting killed. Everyone's getting killed. Barbers, professors, officers, insurgents, Americans. Everyone's getting killed. So what are you going to write?
Mike Hoyt is the executive editor of the Columbia Journalism Review and editor of the book Reporting Iraq, an oral history of the war by the journalists who covered it. Steve Paulson spoke with him. Brian Palmer is your consummate journalist. He's worked as a staff writer at Fortune magazine, Beijing bureau chief for U.S. News and World Report, and correspondent for CNN. None of that prepared him for the war in Iraq. Palmer embedded with the 1st Battalion, 2nd Marines, three times between 2004 and 2006. His documentary film about his embed experience is called Full Disclosure. And Strange Champs asked Palmer why he chose to embed with U.S. troops in Iraq.
I felt like it was important to be on the ground documenting what U.S. troops were doing in my name. Some of my heroes are war reporters, and I'd never covered a war before. I'd covered Afghanistan as a guy behind a microphone, and I felt that, what can I do as a journalist? I can provide boots-on-the-ground accountability. Mm-hmm. So that's what I wanted to do.
I'm sure before you went, you talked with people, you'd probably seen other reports from other embedded reporters. I would bet that there were still things that surprised you once you got there. What was most surprising?
I found the embedded reporting during the war to be, I keep falling back on the word problematic, but it's a lot of it seemed like cheerleading. And I felt like a lot of the reportage I was seeing on the tube was cheerleading. There were all these profiles of glossy and shiny weapon systems. And anybody knows what war is about. War is about where bullets meet bodies. We can talk politics, we can talk patriotism, but fundamentally, if you're not dealing with that issue, then you're not really doing what you should be doing.
Cease fire! Gentlemen! Let's go, move! Go
right. So you've been back for a while, and you've decided to make a documentary about your experiences. And for that, you've been following one man in particular, Marine Staff Sergeant Marino. Why did you choose him?
I felt like he was a good man. I felt like he genuinely had the respect of the young men under him. I mean, I started going out on patrols with him when he was 24 years old. He's now 27. And I just found myself wanting to know more about him and really wanting to see how a good, honorable, and disciplined Marine conducted himself under these circumstances, given that really I felt he was in an untenable position. And that's not me coming with whatever predisposition or biases I had before the war. This is observing Marines on the ground during several dozen combat patrols, routine patrols. I felt like they were improvising as best they could. They didn't speak Arabic. They hadn't been trained to do the incredibly complicated civil military sort of stuff that they were trying to do. And Marino always did his best. He respected people. And I just found that what better example of an American in Iraq than someone like this?
I think you also said at one point, maybe in your blog, maybe in your film, that with him you had the sense you probably wouldn't die.
Yeah, and that may sound sort of flippant, but it's absolutely true. And there's really not much more to say than that. I don't think I understood that until after I came back. I don't think I understood that until my, 12th or 15th interview with David Marino, when I realized, my God, this man would have given his life for me, which is not a responsibility I would have wanted, but it was one that he accepted. As soon as he took me out on that first patrol in the city of Musayib, four-man patrol in a volatile city that was beset with bombings and all sorts of terrible things, his commanding officer dumped him on me, and he accepted.
I'm curious, you have such sympathy for Sergeant Marino, and yet you were there as a reporter, embedded with this unit, and therefore, having a serious relationship with these guys. You walked around with them all the time. Some of them saved your life. It must have been pretty hard to hold on to any sense of objectivity. And how did that affect your reporting?
Well, there's a scene in the film. There's a firefight. I'm with Marino and his radio operator and his corpsman, people shooting. He's trying to get them to stop shooting. And sort of as this event draws to a climax, I videotape Staff Sergeant Marino firing two rounds into a man. You don't see the man, but you see him fire someone laying in a ditch.
Wait, be careful! Get out! Get out!
Hey, there's a guy right here in the
Where's
brush.
He
he's right in there. I shot him in the face a couple times.
Awesome.
Hey, you on the edge?
Hey, sir. Right here, sir.
Yeah, he's got a weapon still.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't tell if he's got anything on him, sir.
Don't get any closer.
He's dead.
He's pretty much done. I give him one more to the head, sir.
Do it.
Watch out.
Go ahead with it.
He's done.
Let's go, let's push.
Six mobiles, three.
The battalion's executive officer asked me to show him the footage I shot of the firefight. I said sure, as a courtesy to him and to the Marines who kept me alive. I don't have a problem with any of this video, the XO told me, except for the 10 seconds where Staff Sergeant Marino fires those last two rounds into the guy lying in the ditch. Taken out of context, he said, people back home won't know that the man might have been strapped with C4, a plastic explosive that could have killed Marines and you. And he said, I'd appreciate it if you didn't use that video. I can't tell you what to do. It's your call, but I'd appreciate it.
So what did you decide to do?
It will be in the film, and I've talked to Staff Sergeant Marino about it. I said to him, are you comfortable with me airing everything that we've done, everything that I've seen you do over these 3+ years? And he said, absolutely.
What would you have done if he'd said no?
The first thing is I probably would have gone back on my pledge, to quit drinking. But I would have honored his request. Bottom line, I would have honored his request. I mean, it's a very, very, very difficult thing and probably not the best thing for a journalist to do. But, yeah, that's probably where I would have gone.
Were there times, have there ever been times when you censored yourself? You know, when you turned the camera off, walked away, didn't ask the question that you knew you probably should?
Yes, ma'am, would be the short response to that. My very first day in country, July 2004, there was a mortar attack. It was my first time in a war zone. Mortars, you know, they're little bombs that are fired from 2 or 3 miles away. They explode and throw shrapnel. So I was actually sort of pushed to the bottom of a bomb shelter by a bunch of Marines. And then when things calmed down, I followed the master sergeant of the unit that I was with, the company that I was with, into the battalion aid station. And there was a Marine lying on the floor in a pool of blood. And corpsmen were working on him. And one of the Marines to my left screamed as I picked my still camera up to my face and screamed, "What the F is he doing here?" And we had a little exchange, and then I decided voluntarily to leave. I didn't shoot the picture of that young Marine, a kid from Chatham, New Jersey, who bled out. He died. And I wrote about that in a blog. I sort of agonized, and I got an email from the dead Marine's mother who said, "I think you made the right choice by not photographing my son die." I know that would have been the right choice for her. I still don't know to this day, I mean, whether I made the right decision. I don't know if there is a right decision. I don't think there is a right decision.
Brian Palmer embedded with the 1st Battalion, 2nd Marines, three times between 2004 and 2006. His documentary film is called Full Disclosure. He spoke with Anne Strainchamps. Have an opinion about embedded journalism? Send us your thoughts through our website at ttbook.org/bootsontheground. Coming up, the story behind the abuses at Abu Ghraib.
You can kill people off camera. You can shoot people. You could, you know, blow their heads off. As long as it's not on camera, you're okay. But if it's on camera, you're done.
For To the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Covering the War, is part of our special series, Boots on the Ground, Stories from the War in Iraq, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. The abuse of Iraqi prisoners by U.S. soldiers at Abu Ghraib is the epitome of the fog of war.
We didn't kill them. We didn't cut their heads off. We didn't cut them and let them bleed to death. We just did what we were told to soften them up for interrogation. And we were told to do anything short of killing them. We'd make them stand in awkward positions for hours at a time to stress them out.
Point at him and laugh at him while he was in the shower naked. Cut off all his clothes with a knife, burn them with a cigarette. We just do what they want us to do.
Scenes from Errol Morris's documentary film Standard Operating Procedure. Morris and journalist Philip Gurevich have written a companion book that examines what really happened at Abu Ghraib. It's not only a disturbing account of U.S. policy, and I should warn you, you will hear graphic descriptions of torture and humiliation in the next interview. It's also a philosophical meditation on what photographs can and cannot tell us about the truth. Gurevich told Steve Paulson that few people know the real story of Abu Ghraib, despite those nauseating photos.
The focus at the time that the photographs came out and subsequently has almost entirely been on the photographs themselves, allowing the photographs, as it were, to frame the story for us and for us to sort of not see what they don't show.
Let's talk about those photographs for a moment, because this is what generated so much attention around the world. Naked prisoners stacked like a pyramid on top of each other, a soldier holding a man who's been collared by what looks like a dog leash, and perhaps most troubling of all, that picture of a hooded prisoner standing on a box with wires dangling from his outstretched arms. How much do those photos reveal about what actually happened at Abu Ghraib?
a lot and a little at the same time. Each of those photographs has, as you would imagine, a full story behind it. We have the habit of assuming that a photograph offers us a kind of visual completeness and tells the story completely, rather than treating it as we would, let's say, a bloody sock or a stray bullet that was found at the scene of a crime, as a piece of evidence that invites us to look and investigate more closely. That's what a photograph should be seen as, a fraction of a second captured in a frame that tells you something was happening but requires you to ask what was happening. And in these cases, each of those famous iconic photographs has a very different story. The story of Lindy England holding what looks like a dog leash with a naked man at the end of it, crawling on the ground, was actually the story of a cell extraction gone slightly awry, in which a man who was kept already naked in a cell, put there by other people, previous guards, who had been hurling threats and stones and spitting at American guards, the people on the night shift, the MPs on the night shift, who are the MPs who were implicated in all of the photographs and who took them, were told, you've got to get him out of that isolation cell and make it available to somebody else. So Charles Grainer, who was in charge of the night shift for the MPs, thought, well, how am I supposed to do this? And he took a tie-down strap, a strap that you'd use to tie cargo to a Humvee. And he went down to the cell and he brought along with him Lindy England, who was his girlfriend and just hanging out that night with him. And he made a little loop and he dropped the loop of this strap around the guy's shoulders. And he gave it a little tug, and it went up around his neck, and the man started to crawl out of the cell.
Grainer had the camera in his cargo pocket, and he asked me and Ambule to come downstairs with him. He would have never had me standing next to Gus if the camera wasn't there. A 95 to 100-pound female, short female at that, holding a strap that's attached to his neck. I'm dominating him. Maybe that's what Grainer was going for. Maybe it was for documentation, maybe it was for his own amusement. I don't know. I don't know what was going through his head.
Grainer says, you know, the reason I took my camera with me is when I worked for the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections, whenever we did a planned use of force and anything might go awry, we took video cameras along. Which is interesting because he's saying it's actually almost a kind of safeguard in being able to make account for yourself.
Which is interesting because the sort of the mystery for so many people is why in the world would they take these pictures? I mean, all it does is incriminate them.
Well, that's the assumption. The assumption is that it's self-incriminating and therefore both foolish and deeply depraved or perverse and kinky, that they're doing it for their own pleasure entirely. And there's no question that there are elements of play that get introduced, a certain kind of gallows humor, pranking that gets introduced into some of the posing in the photographs.
Yes, they do beat the prisoners. I don't think it's right and never have. That's why I take the pictures. To prove the story I tell people.
Sabrina Harmon ends up in a lot of these photos, and for instance, there's one famous one where she's giving the thumbs up sign and she's smiling as she poses with a dead prisoner, someone who had been killed during interrogation.
That's right, but that prisoner had not been killed by her, nor did she have a hand in his death. He had been killed 15, 16 hours earlier during an interrogation by a CIA agent who secretly was holding him at the prison. And it was subsequent to that that as they were trying to figure out how to dispose of his body, they left it in the showers there for the time being. Sabrina Harmon went in and she took a series of photographs in which she opened the body bag. And it's very important to understand, Sabrina Harmon in civilian life, her ambition was to become a forensic photographer, a crime scene photographer. By pure coincidence, she winds up at Abu Ghraib and starts documenting what essentially are crime scenes around her, some of which she's, in a sense, involved in or implicated in by virtue of being a guard.
And the other thing that's striking is, I mean, what so horrifies us when we look at these photos is she's smiling. She looks like she's having fun. But when you hear her describe it, it's, well, I didn't know what else to do when the camera was on me. That's sort of what I do is I smile to try to look good. I mean, it's sort of, it's bizarre when you hear that.
And I think it's important to understand that we were very distracted by that smile, rightly because it's disturbing, but that the smile itself is not what's really revealing in that photograph. What's revealing is that an American prisoner was murdered, and the Army judged that death a homicide within a week. And the only person who's ever been prosecuted for it is the woman who took photographs that alerted the rest of us to the fact that a prisoner had been murdered, whereas although the CIA agent who was interrogating him has also been identified. His name is Swanner. He is living in freedom and has never been charged, nor has anybody else, for the actual crime of killing the man.
There are some CIA guys there. They asked us to handcuff him to the window, so he has to hold himself up because he was playing possum. And I'm just holding him by the jumpsuit. And I remember how, like, far back his arms were going. And, you know, this guy's pretty damn good because, you know, his arms are almost about to break, or so I'm surprised they haven't broken. I'm waiting for the pop. And then all of a sudden, just like, I guess, blood started pouring out of his nose and mouth. And so we realized something was, you know, was wrong.
That's when I went and raised the hood. And that's the first time I saw his face. I was surprised because his face was totally messed up. He got a huge black eyes with bruises everywhere. And I was like, whoa, what happened to this guy? This whole time we were messing with this guy, you know, carrying him and lifting him. And this entire time the guy was dead.
It's worth pointing out that no one above the rank of staff sergeant has served jail time for anything that happened at Abu Ghraib. I mean, it's just the grunts who have served time, and often people who really didn't do much of anything.
It's absolutely crucial to understand that. And I think there's a huge confusion that's taken place between the act of taking the photographs and the acts that the photographs depict. We forget that it's the thing that's being depicted that we need to think about and investigate. And that thing is policy. What you saw at Abu Ghraib was not the invention of a few undisciplined soldiers. What you saw were soldiers doing what, largely and broadly speaking, was required and or expected of them. The nudity that you see in those photographs preceded their arrival at Abu Ghraib. On that ward, at that prison, American soldiers were holding what were called the high-value detainees, the detainees who had been captured during the insurgency and were believed to have the highest value as interrogation subjects for gathering intelligence about the insurgency. They were being held there naked. They were being held there chained to bars in painful stress positions. The sexual element of humiliation and the physical element of torturous positions were both in place when they arrived, and they were told this is what military intelligence wants you to do, you the guards, in preparing the conditions for breaking them in interrogation.
When you walk from the main portion of the prison and you get to 1A1B, they already had intelligence detainees down there. That's when I saw the nakedness. I'm like, hey, Sarge, why is everyone naked? You know, hey, that's the MI. That's what the MI does. That's the MI thing. I don't know. Why do these guys have on women's panties? They're like, it was to break them. The guy's naked, guys in women's panties, guys in, you know, handcuffed in stress positions, cells, no lights, no windows. It's like, whoa, what is that? It's like, hey, that's military intelligence. You know, just stay out their way. And from then on, I was like, something's not right here.
Let me mention the response that I heard from Douglas Feith, whom I recently interviewed. He's, of course, one of the architects of the War on Terrorism, who served under Donald Rumsfeld in the Pentagon. And he made the argument, along with other people in the Bush administration, that the Geneva Convention rules did not apply to these detainees, particularly Abu Ghraib, because they were not the conventional prisoners of war. Let me play this bit of the interview, an excerpt from this interview with Douglas Feith.
There were cases where, as in Abu Ghraib in Iraq, where people did absolutely dreadful, disgusting, sexually perverted things that were a violation of the rules. But there were rules. There were always rules. There was never a case where somebody said anything goes.
So it was just a case of a few bad apples.
Well, in the case of Abu Ghraib, what was done there was done by people who were not doing it pursuant to orders. They were not doing it for interrogation purposes. They were just doing something absolutely disgusting. I mean, the kind of stuff that happens in prisons when people get abused. We had a policy that had rules in place, and we had a policy to punish people who violated it. What happened in Abu Ghraib, for example, is as soon as somebody in the military who was not involved in the abuses learned about what had happened and saw some of the photographs, that person immediately triggered a criminal investigation, which was the proper thing to do.
Okay. How do you respond to those comments by Douglas Feith?
Either he's profoundly ignorant or he's being profoundly deceptive. It's not consonant with the facts about Abu Ghraib. The facts here are that the administration, almost immediately after September 11th, set about trying to dismantle the rules that existed for the protection of prisoners under interrogation, and specifically for finding loopholes in the Geneva Conventions and in the Convention Against Torture, Cruel, Inhuman, and Degrading Punishment. And they did a good job. And I say that not ironically. The weaknesses that they detected in Geneva and in the insufficiency or imprecision of the definition of torture, those are genuine weaknesses in those laws. They opened up those weaknesses, and in that sort of legal gray zone, they created a set of rules that exploited all the laxity that they could. Here we have an outcome that is as un-American as the behavior in those photographs, and that is the little guy is left to swing while the higher-ups distance themselves, cover up, and deny what they asked for.
There would be no shock the world, no scandal, if there was any photographs. It went away, it went underneath a rock, and that'd have been the end of it.
Photographs are what they are. You can interpret them differently, but what the photograph depicts is what it is. You can put any kind of meaning to it, but you are seeing what happened at that snapshot in time.
You can kill people off camera. You can shoot people. You could, you know, blow their heads off. As long as it's not on camera, you're okay. But if it's on camera, you're done. You know, torture didn't happen in those photographs. That was humiliation. That was softening up. Torture happened during interrogations. Guys going through interrogation, and they're dead, and they were killed, and they died. That's where the torture happened. We don't have photographs of that.
Excerpts from Errol Morris's interviews with American soldiers who worked at Abu Ghraib prison. Morris and Philip Gurevich are the authors of the book Standard Operating Procedure, which is also the title of Morris's documentary film. Gurevich spoke with Steve Paulson. Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez served as commander of coalition forces in Iraq from June 2003 to June 2004. General Sanchez led the coalition forces at the height of the war. He was there for the capture of Saddam Hussein, the start of the insurgency, and the outbreak of Shiite-Sunni violence. He was also the commander during the scandal at Abu Ghraib. Steve Paulson sat down with General Sanchez and asked him about Abu Ghraib.
You write in the preface of your book, and I'm quoting here, "Today, after 33 years in the U.S. Army, I can look back with pride on a period of active duty that spanned from the Vietnam era to ground combat in Desert Storm, Kosovo, and Iraq, but my military career ended at a place called Abu Ghraib." How did the abuses at Abu Ghraib happen?
Well, I think there are two key factors that take America off the moral high ground and down the path of torture. The first one, clearly, is the lifting of the Geneva Conventions in 2002. And then once those constraints are lifted from our processes and from our training and from our executing interrogation approaches across the entire global war at this point, in execution, we also fail miserably within the military structures because we do not provide any training, any policy guidance, any oversight mechanisms to the young soldiers that are on the ground executing interrogations and to the military commanders that are on the ground asking for that clarification.
Were the abuses at Abu Ghraib isolated cases of a few bad apples, basically guards gone bad, and that seems to be the official government line? Or was this policy in some way? I mean, did this come down from directives from above that this is the way to break these prisoners?
There was no policy. That was one of my biggest challenges during the summer and fall of 2003. This is where I continue to feed on this gross dereliction of duty, because everybody at higher headquarters knows that this is a significant problem, but yet everybody is afraid to take on the issue at the executive levels in Washington. You know, now we know that there in fact was a stream of documents and legal decisions that had been made that essentially allowed this to happen in other theaters, and also within the construct of the other agencies that were conducting strategic interrogations in support of the global war.
Now, you have talked about the complex nature of who was involved in interrogations. There were several different agencies involved. You were the commander of coalition forces in Iraq during this time. Do you feel some sense of overall responsibility for what happened at Abu Ghraib?
Absolutely. You know, probably one of my biggest failures is that I don't issue guidance quickly enough, because we're waiting for Washington and Central Command to give us some sort of guidance on how we're supposed to execute these interrogations, and we wait until September to issue my policies. If I had issued those policies in the early summer after my first visit to Abu Ghraib, where we very quickly realized that our training was wholly inadequate, the oversight mechanisms were non-existent, that's when we begin to work on these policies. We didn't act fast enough. And if we had imposed those, then we might have been able to prevent some of this. But I think you have to, you know, America has to understand that because I was a coalition force commander in the country doesn't mean that I was controlling the CIA and the special forces. They're operating as independent organizations in the country. And as a matter of fact, the CIA reports to Ambassador Bremer and then back to Washington. And the special forces are working in coordination with us, but they report to General Abizaid at Central Command.
Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez served as commander of coalition forces in Iraq from June 2003 to June 2004. His memoir is called Wiser in Battle, A Soldier's Story. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Coming up, a documentary filmmaker turns the cameras over to the soldiers.
I had heard stories about it, but when I got those tapes and put them in the deck and heard it and heard guys who I knew yelling and screaming and the chaos, it was really overwhelming.
Did anybody clear those rooms yet? Okay.
Through your mind, is today the day? Are they going to get hit? Are they going to be okay? Are they back safely within the wire? I mean, my computer was on 24/7. You know, my IM windows were always open. It was very nerve-wracking.
For To the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Covering the War, is part of our special series, Boots on the Ground, Stories from the War in Iraq, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. There's been a lot of talk about the pros and cons of the embed program. Filmmaker Deborah Scranton cut the middleman right out of that discussion and went straight to the source, troops on the ground. She supplied the cameras, and they cover the war. Scranton says what's important is giving soldiers and Marines the chance to press their own record button on this war. The resulting film is called The War Tapes. Scranton is the film's director.
It was filmed by the soldiers themselves on the front lines. They mounted the cameras, you know, on the dashboards of the Humvees, on the gun turrets, in other places as well. And it really gives you a view through their eyes as their experience unfolded, what it looked like.
How did you get this set up? How did this film get made?
based on an earlier film I had made on World War II vets from my small town, the New Hampshire National Guard, Major Greg Hileshorn, who's the public affairs officer for the New Hampshire National Guard, called me with an offer to embed in any of the units that were deploying for OIF-2 in 2004. And my idea, literally, I went to sleep and woke up in the middle of the night with an idea of what if I were to, in effect, virtually embed and to give the soldiers cameras and work with them in a permeable relationship over the internet for the Iraq portion. Because what I really wanted to do was to crawl inside the experience of war, to really understand, you know, what it looked like, smelled like, felt like, to see it through their eyes.
It is a big difference, isn't it? If you were to have gone with a camera and accompanied these guys, what got filmed and what got set probably would have been very different.
Yeah, definitely. I also think that my background in television, I had done a lot of sports work, so I was very comfortable with a multi-camera filming platform. And I think we increased the facets of what you can see by having two cameras in one vehicle, you know, one up on the turret and one down below in the vehicle. Plus, normally when the platforms would go out, when the Humvees would go out, there'd be at least three, if not six, in a convoy. So we could have, you know, at one point we had 21 cameras filming. So there could be out on, you know, on a mission, several cameras filming, which would all give you a different perspective that then could be cut together to give you a fuller view of what that day was like.
How did it get decided who was going to have the cameras?
Well, the caveat for my access was once I picked the unit, which was Charlie Company, 3rd of the 172nd, it's a mountain infantry, it's the only infantry unit in the state of New Hampshire. The caveat for my access was that I had to ask the soldiers to volunteer. So I went down to Fort Dix with my executive producer, Chuck Lacey, and a crew, and I hopped out in front of the unit, the 180 guys, and told them my vision, and I made them a promise. I said that we would tell the story wherever it took us, no matter what. And 10 soldiers stepped forward and volunteered to carry cameras and to work with me.
Did you feel as though everybody understood before they left what it was that you were expecting to get out of this? Did you have a kind of shared vision of what the film was going to be made up of when they came home?
No, because we had no way of knowing, you know, how it would work, what it was going to be like. I mean, when they left, things were pretty quiet. But basically, once they got there, if you go back and look at the headlines, all hell broke loose. I mean, that was the April uprising. That's when they hung those four contractors' bodies off the bridge in Fallujah. You know, the war was back on. And we had no way of knowing when they went over how much, you know, action they would see. And in effect, they had over 225 direct enemy engagements while they were there. They saw a lot of action.
Some of this film is just extraordinary. It's not what you see on the news. In fact, I was a little surprised that the Defense Department stuck to its deal with you because, as you say, things changed once they got over there. And this is, well, not everybody comes off as pristine in the end as maybe they wished they would.
Army truck drivers make 17 grand a year, you know, E5. So they outsource it, privatize, save the Army money, and now we pay KBR 120 grand, do the same job. KBR annoys me. I don't want to talk politics, but man, they got it good. Take every store in your town and let it all be run by one company. I mean, that's basically what they do. They have their hands in anything you can think of. KBR runs all our chow halls.
Today we're having Middle Eastern Swedish meatballs and Iraqi freedom fries.
Look at all these plates, huh?
To charge the military food, they're going to put out 4,000 plates times $28 a plate. So when people take two, because sometimes we take one and then we'll take one and put it on top to keep it warm, it's $56 KBR just charged the government.
Every war has got its own little term to dehumanize the other side. We had gooks in Vietnam, and this war has Hajis. It becomes almost like a filler, you know. Anybody that's non-American almost becomes a Haji. It originated because a lot of the older men in the Arab culture has been done their pilgrimage to Mecca, so when you come back, you become a Haji. So it's used by Arabs, for Arabs, as a term of respect, but somehow I don't think a US soldier on a patrol is using it in that context.
The New Hampshire National Guard was very supportive of the project and were very committed to the soldiers being able to tell the story because they're the ones who are fighting and dying in our name to help bridge the disconnect. Because I think one of the biggest issues we're facing right now is this disconnect between someone who knows a soldier and, you know, those who don't. And I think it's very, very important until we start seeing soldiers as our neighbors, as us. You know, it shouldn't be an us and them. It needs to be a we. I mean, back in World War II, there was the home front, there was the war front. You know, people had victory gardens. I mean, you can go for days in this country and not really know that there's a war going on. The most important thing is that, you know, wars are done and fought and won or lost by ordinary people. And it's my greatest hope that the war tapes will help to bridge that disconnect between those who know a soldier and those who don't. I would share just one story with you. When the film premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival, all five soldiers who filmed all year were there for the Q&A after. A woman got up and asked a question, and she said, you know, what can I do, what can we do to help soldiers? And they all had their comments, but Brandon Wilkins, who's a Down East Mainer, a man of few words, you know, very eloquently said, get to know one. And he's right. For me, the most memorable moment came when a soldier came up to me. Because usually at the Q&As, the soldiers who are in the audiences don't normally say anything. They wait until it's all over, and they kind of hang back, and then they'll come up to me, and I'm pretty sure that I know that they're the soldiers. And this one guy came up, and he stood really close to me and looked down at me, and I saw his eyes fill up, and I was like, it's okay. And he started out with, my gunner was throwing candy, and I knew exactly what he was going to say. And he said, you know, I haven't been able to tell my family yet that we hit and killed a kid. I'm a father. I have kids of my own. I'm afraid they're going to think I'm a monster. And he said, but after seeing your film, I'm going to bring my wife back, and we're going to go see your film, and I'm going to tell her. And it's moments like that, which is why I do what I do.
Deborah Scranton is the director of the documentary film, The War Tapes. For To the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour is called Covering the War. It's part of our special series, Boots on the Ground, Stories from the War in Iraq, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio. This series was produced by Charles Monroe Kane, with the help of Veronica Rickert, Anne Strainchamps, Doug Gordon, Mary Lou Finnegan, Claire Radomski, and Madeline Mayen. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. Original theme music for Boots on the Ground, Stories from the War in Iraq, was written by Steve Mullen at Walk West Productions. For more information on this series, please go to our website at ttbook.org/bootsontheground.
PRI, Public Radio International.